From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. On average, 5 times an hour, an American dies by suicide, and many, many more, more than a million adults each year, try to take their own lives and fail. It seems epidemic, but an economist at the National Institute of Mental Health, Michael Schoenbaum, says some straightforward steps would make a difference. If emergency rooms just asked every patient whether they're thinking of suicide, he says, we'd find twice as many people as we do now, and we would not plant the idea.
The one take-home message that I try to include when I talk to any audience about suicide prevention is that it is safe to ask.
Schoenbaum has other advice and notes that of those who are sidetracked from suicide, 9 out of 10 will not go on to die that way. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. America loses someone to suicide every 12 minutes. The suicide rate has increased almost 30% in the last 2 decades. The good news is that only a small percent of suicide attempts succeed. A survey by the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration estimates that 1.4 million adults had attempted suicide in the previous year. Millions more had thought about it. No doubt mistaken to call it good news that more than a million Americans wanted to end their lives, took action to do it, and failed. More tragedy averted than good news. What can we do about suicide? As it becomes more common, it seems more stubborn, more difficult to address. But there's research indicating there are steps we can take to more quickly find people who are thinking of taking their lives and to help them more effectively. One of the leaders in that research is an economist at the National Institutes of Mental Health. Michael Schoenbaum, Ph.D., is Senior Advisor for Mental Health Services, Epidemiology, and Economics, and he joins us on the line from NPR in Washington. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
We're both on the board of the Mental Health Association of Maryland, where I heard you speak about this issue. And you began by saying, I'm an economist, not a mental health expert. How is your approach different?
One reason that I mentioned that at the beginning of presentations is to clarify that I'm not a clinician. My training is in more of a public health approach to look at populations, and that is valuable for understanding patterns of risk and also for understanding what works. It's very difficult to understand both risk and effective interventions if you're only looking at individuals. You have to look across populations.
Let's talk about detecting who is having suicidal thoughts. How do we do that, and how could we do it better?
A kind of stylized way of thinking about how we currently work to identify people with suicide risk is to we pursue either of two things. And again, this is pretty broad. But one is that we cross our fingers and hope that people self-identify. They could tell somebody in their lives, a clinician, a faith leader, a colleague. They could go to a healthcare setting and they could say it, or they could say things that tip off a clinician to look for it. In any case, that or at the extreme, they show up in a healthcare setting or some other setting already having harmed themselves in some way that is suggestive of intentional self-injury. So that's one way that we find people currently. The other way, which is connected, is that we cross our fingers and hope that somebody figures it out. Again, somebody in your private life, somebody in your faith community, someone, a colleague, or more commonly, a clinician. And those methods are essential, but to in combination, they are not nearly enough. If all we do is hope that people identify themselves somehow or hope that somebody catches on, we miss an awful lot of people who need help. And I should say the premise here is that you can't help people if you can't find them. So that's why finding them is so important. So we've learned some new ways to find people that we should start using more widely.
The new ways are what?
Well, two ways. One is sounds simple, and the other sounds complicated. The one that sounds simple is ask people. It turns out that this is particularly relevant in healthcare settings, and it's especially relevant in a healthcare setting like a hospital emergency department, because a lot of people with suicide risk, it turns out, present to a hospital emergency department. And so what we have learned to do, particularly in emergency departments, is what's called screening for suicide risk. It turns out that there are people who will say, they will admit, if you will, that they are thinking about suicide or have plans to kill themselves, but they will only say it if you ask. So the research that has been conducted in hospital emergency departments has found that compared to the current practice, where again, we either hope that someone will self-identify or hope that a clinician will guess correctly, if a hospital emergency department asks everyone, no matter what they're there for, and I should say everyone age 10 and over is what the research supports right now, if they are considering suicide, compared to current practice, we end up finding twice as many people who need help for suicide risk as we are currently finding, 2x. And that's a pretty big effect. And it turns out, the research has also found that when you look at those people, the researchers do this, when you look back at their medical records or when you get a chance to interview them, the people we are identifying if we screen them actually have apparently similar suicide risk as the people we are currently identifying. So these are real cases. They're not just people who take the opportunity to say something on a whim when somebody asks them. They're really suicidal, but in some cases even they are waiting for somebody to ask them, but they won't volunteer it.
I think parents and friends of people are worried about planting the idea if they ask.
Yeah, that's a fair question. Turns out even health professionals are worried about the possibility that if you ask somebody, especially somebody who seems vulnerable or struggling, if you ask them about suicide risk, that you might be causing harm somehow. We have research on this too, and the evidence suggests that is simply not the case. It's a plausible concern. I understand it. I even maybe at some point shared it. But we now know from research, there's no evidence that you will be planting ideas in someone's head. The one take-home message that I try to include when I talk to any audience about suicide prevention is that it is safe to ask. If someone in your life seems to be struggling, if a friend or colleague seems to be struggling, it's safe to ask. That doesn't mean it's easy to ask. It's hard even for professionals often. I don't want to put unfair burden or expectations on people who are not trained to do this kind of thing. But if they are thinking about it and it occurs to them maybe to ask, they should be reassured that it is safe to do so. Now, you do also have to have some idea about what to do if someone says yes, and there, of course, the answers are very different if you're a friend or family member or a coworker, a layperson, than if you're a health professional.
That's economist Michael Schoenbaum, senior advisor for mental health services at the National Institute of Mental Health. Here on The Record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about ways to cut the number of suicides. You mentioned that the screening is being done. Is it being done by all emergency rooms? How widespread is it?
It is not. So all emergency departments and many other healthcare providers are now required as a condition of accreditation, right? The certification that healthcare providers undergo. Most of them are required to screen some patients. In particular, they're required to screen patients who are clearly seeking care for mental health or substance use problems. And that's fine. So those are mental health and substance use conditions are certainly risk factors for suicide. And so it is appropriate to expect that healthcare providers and facilities screen patients like that. What is not so common yet is so-called universal screening. So in the emergency department, it would literally be every patient age 10 and over at every visit would be screened for suicide risk. But the practice is not yet widespread, and it is certainly not required as part of the standard of care.
You speak about another approach called predictive modeling. What is predictive modeling?
I'll start by giving an analogy. I would think almost everybody with a credit card has had the experience of getting contacted by their credit card company inquiring about a transaction on their account. The credit card company isn't calling up and saying, this transaction is fraud. They're contacting you and saying, Sheila, we see this transaction on your account. If you recognize it, fine. If you don't recognize it, please get back to us.
Because it doesn't fit your pattern.
Right. So the credit card companies have learned from mining those data to identify profiles of transactions that look like they have a high likelihood of being fraud. So it turns out that health systems can do exactly the same kind of thing now using information on their patients or beneficiaries from electronic health record data. And together with information about you, health systems have learned that one can, in essence, build profiles of a small fraction of a beneficiary population with really high predicted risk for suicide, not to identify someone as a ticking time bomb, and importantly, not to take shortcuts about exactly what you should do for somebody like this. But it is at the stage now, based on validated research and accumulated practice from some innovative health systems, particularly the Veterans Administration, it is at the stage of saying, well, here's a small slice of a larger population where patients like this, we need to give them more attention. We need to reach out to them. We need to invite them to come meet with a clinician so that they can be evaluated because the algorithm says they have high risk for suicide.
What are the dots you're trying to connect? What kind of clues in somebody's pattern are you looking for in predictive modeling?
We are looking for characteristics and experiences that are statistically associated with suicide risk. We're not trying to understand the why of suicide in a causal sense. The computer can't do that, and even human beings, clinicians, researchers haven't in any robust way been able to identify the whys. We're trying to identify signals so that we can pay extra attention to people with certain kind of profiles. Well, what the computer work has shown us is that if you want to get to a risk profile where the people in that profile have 20 or 30 or 50 times not two or three or five times the risk. You have to look across a lot of different characteristics, not three things or five things or 10 things. You have to look across 50 or 200 things and let the computer calculate these profiles.
We need to pause in our conversation with economist Michael Schoenbaum of the National Institute of Mental Health. The number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. When we're back from a quick break on the record, we'll look at some simple ways to connect to people thinking of suicide. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning about suicide. It's the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. More than 47,000 Americans killed themselves in 2017, and it's growing more common. We're speaking with economist Michael Schoenbaum, Ph.D., Senior Advisor for Mental Health Services, Epidemiology, and Economics at the National Institute of Mental Health. We talked about some of his research on detecting people with suicidal thoughts. He also researches effective ways to connect with people thinking of suicide. So someone who's having suicidal thoughts, maybe they were screened at an emergency room or matched a profile, and many listeners will think, okay, get them counseling or psychiatric help and hope for the best. But you've looked at some additional strategies.
So we have more tools in the toolbox than people think. One thing that can be done for people within a clinical encounter where they are identified with suicide risk is a relatively simple intervention called safety planning. And in safety planning, someone with some clinical training, but it does not have to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist, it can be a nurse or a social worker, sits down with the patient during the visit, before they go home, and talks through some strategies that get documented on a piece of paper that the patient goes home with. The goal is to document both things the patient can do to help themselves and things the patient could remind themselves to avoid. So, for example, they can document ways to make their environment safer when they go home. If people have firearms, they can come up with strategies for temporary removal of access to the firearms. The same for medications that could be used to harm oneself or to alcohol or other substances. The safety plan also includes documented reminders to oneself of coping strategies that the patient finds successful. Friends they can contact, exercise, walks, things they enjoy doing that they write down to remind themselves that in the event of stress, these are things that help them. And then the last section focuses on things that they know increase their stress. Friends that if they hang out with that person, they might end up drinking or otherwise be exposed to stressors that they would prefer to avoid. It's a relatively simple thing, but if you walk through it systematically and you document it, the research has found that this actually does substantially reduce people's risk for a subsequent suicide event.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with economist Michael Schoenbaum of the National Institutes of Mental Health about ways to reduce suicides. So the other thing I've heard you talk about is caring contacts, which you said is really an idea developed 40 years ago.
Yeah, this is another simple sounding idea that turns out to have really striking benefits. The idea is that after someone is identified with suicide risk in a healthcare setting, at whatever point you send them home, we have learned that if after they go home, we, the health system, reaches out to them, either in writing or by telephone, recurrently over, let's say, a 6 to 12 month period, with simple messages of encouragement, that kind of outreach has been shown now in multiple randomized control trials, the kind of gold standard of evidence in medicine. Multiple trials have found that that reduces subsequent suicide attempts and deaths by about a third, which from where I sit is really striking. Because when this was invented by a psychologist named Jerry Mata in the 1970s, he literally sent people postcards. And the postcards were simple. It was expressions of support. He didn't even ask them to do anything. In fact, he specifically avoided asking them to do anything, like engage in follow-up healthcare. He literally was just writing them to acknowledge that he was thinking of them and to express the hope that they were doing well. That messaging and those findings have now been repeated, not with postcards. Postcards aren't adequately private, but you can send people letters. This has been done now using text messaging, kind of 21st century caring contacts. And it's also been done via telephone outreach. It's every few weeks initially, and then every few months over the course of the first year after someone has been identified, to reach out and express support and encouragement. If I could wave a magic wand, I would say that such programs should be part of the standard of care. We should provide them to everybody routinely. But currently, unfortunately, we don't. So that's a direction we, based on the science, I think we should be working in.
Is there any research on who is most effective when they reach out? I mean, does it need to be someone from the health system or a family or a friend reaching out? Does it have the same impact?
We haven't tried this with family and friends reaching out. And I am actually personally reluctant. I'm very protective of peers, and friends and family are peers. So far, this has been conducted using people with professional training and supervision, but it does not have to be mental health specialty providers. Just as safety planning can be provided effectively via nurses or social workers, they don't have to be doctoral level mental health clinicians.
Isn't the very time that someone is at risk of committing suicide the time that they're not going to follow whatever safety plan they've planned out?
Well, first of all, we don't understand the why of any of this, really. And so we don't understand the why of suicide, and maybe we don't understand the why of why interventions that turn out to work are actually working, right? Maybe our intuition, I even share your intuition about safety planning, right? That you're engaging somebody at a time of crisis, and this should be the time they're least likely to respond to things like this. It turns out, I think, a lot of us have the wrong idea about suicidality. One statistic I think is really striking and that most people don't know is that even for people who survive a serious suicide attempt, more than 90% of such people, if they survive the attempt, will go on to die of something that isn't suicide. So the idea that this is just inevitable, or that people are in a prolonged state where this is what they're committed to doing, and what can we do about it anyway, that turns out it doesn't map to actual human behavior. Of course, there are people like that, but again, if 90% of people, or more than 90% of people who survive a serious suicide attempt go on to die of something that isn't suicide, it suggests there's a lot that we can do.
It does. Thank you for sharing that. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for your interest in this.
Michael Schoenbaum is Senior Advisor for Mental Health Services, Epidemiology, and Economics at the National Institute of Mental Health. And again, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, we have links to more information and resources. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us on the record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.